Hey, Monster Hunters. If you're enjoying Beast and Bible, please rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. And don't forget to share it with somebody who might like it. Now, on to the show.
Me and my sister, we have a past. We almost died at the hands of a witch. But that past made us stronger. We'd gotten a taste of blood, witch blood. And we haven't stopped since.
Hansel and Gretel, Witch Hunters, was a superhero-style take on the classic Grimm's fairy tale. Instead of two terrified kids at the mercy of a candy architect with cannibalistic tendencies, this movie sees the brother-sister duo as dealing with their childhood trauma by tracking down witches as adults and dispatching them with extreme prejudice. In this episode, we return to our tracking down of the Witch of Endor with the intensity of the elder Hansel and Gretel, minus the violence. I hope you're excited to rejoin Dr. Turner and I as we conclude the episode, Which Way Did She Go? I'm Dr. Seth Pierce, and welcome back to Beast and Bible. So to the problem of the medium, so keeping this in mind, how do we get at some sort of, I don't want to necessarily remove all the tension from scripture, because sometimes I think it's important and sometimes I think, you know, it's just there. But how do we maybe reduce some of the tension now that we have an interpretive key when trying to understand who this woman was and what she did?
Okay, well, one way of looking at that is in keeping in our mind the parallelism between these two narratives of Abigail and the medium. If we just look at the simple thing, first of all, with Abigail, what does Abigail do? And the reason why I want to look at what Abigail does is because we find the medium doing the same kind of thing, but there's a kind of a twist to it. You know, it isn't just a straightforward, and it isn't necessarily a straightforward answer either. It's kind of an invitation to the reader to make this kind of connection. But the basic thing with Abigail is Samuel is dead. We're told that at the beginning of the story. He can no longer speak. So what Abigail does to begin with is she repeats what Samuel's already said. She tells David, "The Lord has made you king over Israel." We already know that. So she repeats what he said. But she goes on to say something which Samuel never said. So she makes a prediction for which there is no precedent. And it is that the Lord's going to make you a royal house, David. There's going to be the house of David, and the Lord is going to protect you from your enemies. Now, Samuel never said anything like that. However, later on in 2 Samuel, Nathan the prophet receives the word of the Lord, and he's speaking to David, and what he does is basically repeat Abigail's prediction. So this is the prophet Nathan later saying, "You know, David, the Lord's going to make you into a royal house that's going to go on through the generations, and the Lord will give you protection from your enemies." So what Abigail says about the future is confirmed by a prophet of the Lord later. So we have no problems with Abigail. Her predictions are correct because they're later confirmed by events and by a further prophetic word. So that's important to bear in mind, just sort of keep it, you know, in our memory just for a moment. Then the other thing is we're moving towards the medium now. What really helps is if we understand how mediumship and necromancy worked in the ancient world. Now, cutting a long story short here, when a client went to a medium in the ancient world, they wanted to make contact with the dead. The dead were not raised and spoke directly to the client. What happened was that the medium would communicate Isaiah 8 talks about mediums and necromancers who chirp and mutter. So how it worked was this. The medium is saying, yes, I've got in contact with the dead, and then there'd be some unintelligible language that the medium would speak. That's what the dead is speaking. Now, allow me to interpret that into intelligible language for you. So the significant point there is that throughout the seance, it is the medium who is speaking all the time. The dead is not in direct communication with the client. And that this was the, you know, the understood way in which this happened in the Greek version of the Old Testament, the Septuagint, the Greek translation for the medium is a word that means literally ventriloquist.
Yep.
That's how it interprets it. So the medium of Endor is the ventriloquist of Endor. She's the one doing the talking. It's not the dummy sitting on her knee, you know.
Right.
She's
right.
The one doing the talking, the ventriloquist. That's the word they actually use. So what Saul, so when Saul goes to the medium, what he hears is the medium's voice interpreting the alleged communication from the dead Samuel. Not only that, but Saul doesn't see Samuel. Saul sees nothing. Because he says to her, the medium, he says, what do you see? And she tells him. And then he also says, what is his appearance? And she tells him. In other words, he sees nothing. So in the seance, what he hears is the medium speaking, and what he knows about what Samuel looks like is entirely due to what the medium tells him, but he doesn't see anything. That's how it works.
Yeah. It reminds me, looking at, we have another episode this season looking at Adventism and spiritualism in the 19th century.
Right.
And, you know, the Fox Sisters and others, and there were so many tricks, you know, that were used, you know, to convince people. And I'm not minimizing the challenges and dangers with the occult, but so many fraudulent mediums were exposed using all kinds of very sophisticated tricks to make people at the seance believe that they were speaking to the dead. So it's just sort of continuing that, you know, it's a tradition that long predates, you know, 19th century Victorian spiritualism.
Exactly, yes. So the way in which it worked in the ancient world leaves itself open to deception and fraud. It leaves itself open to that. Yeah. So then, coming back to Abigail and the medium as a pair, in light of what I've just said, I hope I can make this point on the roles of the Abigail and the medium being comparable. All right? So,
yes.
Abigail acts as a third party between David and Nabal, whereas the medium acts as a third party, well, as the medium between, you know, the medium is the medium between Saul and Samuel. So they have a comparable role. Abigail speaks throughout the discussion with David. And based on what we know about necromancy, it is the medium who speaks throughout in 1 Samuel 28. It isn't Samuel standing there speaking. She's the one doing the speaking.
Right.
Abigail repeats the prophetic word of Samuel that we already know about, that he gave to David. And the medium, the one who's doing the speaking, she repeats also the prophetic word of Samuel concerning Saul, you know, that the Lord has rejected you and so on. Well, there's nothing new in that. That's
right.
Common knowledge. Jonathan, Saul's son, knew that. Abigail makes predictions about David's future. And this is a critical point, the medium speaking also makes predictions, this time about Saul's future. What's going to happen to him on the following day on the battlefield? So looking at the two then, Abigail speaks like the deceased prophet Samuel.
Yes.
Whereas the medium is speaking allegedly on behalf of the deceased prophet, Samuel.
Wow, yeah.
So their roles and what they do is very significant. However, I said there was a twist, you know, the comparisons, but also contrast. And there are problems with the predictions spoken by the medium in chapter 28. In other words, is she telling the truth? Or let me put it another way, is she giving an accurate prediction? Or
yes.
Is she not giving an accurate prediction? And are her words about Saul's future deceptive? Well, that brings me to maybe the final step in pulling this together, which is this. I spoke about the importance of reading any of the narratives in the books of Samuel in context. But here's a very significant one. If we go back to the normal assumptions made, you know, this is a satanic deception. And that the idea of the satanic deception is not pulled out of any other text within Samuel. It's a necessary ploy to use if the fundamental belief about the state of the dead is correct. However, one of the outstanding characteristics of the book of 1 Samuel and 2 Samuel are the number of incidents which foreground deception. Deception is everywhere. So full-length books have been written on deception in the books of Samuel.
Oh,
so,
wow.
Now, let me try... Well, actually, on that question about deception, just let me mention a few, just so
yeah,
some of them saying
sure, yeah, and we can put those in the show notes as well.
Yeah, okay. So Mickle, for example, Mickle deceives her father Saul. She puts an effigy of David in bed in order to fool the men who come to get him. And when he sees his daughter, he says, "Why have you deceived me?" All right, David deceives the Philistine king Achish. He tells the king he's off doing this when he's actually doing something completely different. He's lying through his teeth. It's another act of deception. Saul
yeah.
himself attempted to deceive the medium. He takes off his royal robes and he puts on the garb of an ordinary person to deceive her into thinking he's not the king.
Yeah.
So it would be a great irony, wouldn't it, that the king who tries to deceive the medium is actually deceived by the medium herself. You know, that's
yes.
kind of a wonderful irony if that were the case. Now,
yeah.
there's another right next to this episode, right sort of cheek by jowl with this. There are two chapters which deserve being read in the same breath as this. I pointed out that chapter 25 and 28, Abigail and the medium, both begin with, "Now Samuel died." So we have two death notices for Samuel. But we also have two death notices for Saul as well. So in 1 Samuel 31, this is the last chapter of 1 Samuel, he's on the battlefield and the narrator tells us how he died. He was surrounded by the Philistines and he calls on his armor bearer to kill him. His armor bearer won't do it, so Saul falls on the sword himself.
Yes.
So the narrator said that's how he dies. Very next chapter, an Amalekite turns up to David, 2 Samuel chapter 1, claiming to be an eyewitness of the death of King Saul. And he says, this is how King Saul died. Saul was, you know, grievously wounded, and he said to me, please kill me so that these Philistines don't get hold of me. So I killed King Saul, and I've brought his crown to you. Now, those two accounts of the death of Saul are mutually exclusive.
Yes.
He either killed himself or the Amalekite killed him. Somebody
right.
is telling lies. Now, who might it be? Would it be the biblical narrator? Is he the one telling his lies? Telling lies? Or if if your mortgage depended on it, would you put your
yeah.
money on the Amalekite as the one who's telling lies in order to ingratiate himself with David?
Right.
That's where I would go. So, in the two accounts of Saul's death, one is the truth and one is a deception. If we come back to the two chapters, 25 and 28, Abigail and the medium, we know that Abigail speaks the truth because Nathan, the prophet of the Lord, later confirms that that is the case. But is the medium telling the truth, or is that deception? So when I say that, consider what she says. When she's saying she's in the role of Samuel, she's speaking on behalf of Samuel. When she talks about the past, she tells what is common knowledge. But when she goes to the future, this is what she says. She says that Saul is going to be killed on the battlefield the following day, that his sons will die. And in context, that has to mean this is the end of the house of Saul. Saul is dead, his sons are dead, and therefore the house of Saul is at an end. Problem is, while Saul is killed the following day, the house of Saul is not at an end, because not all of his sons are killed. One of his sons, Ish-bosheth, goes to the north of the country. He's declared king by Saul's general, Abner, and he reigns for several years, five years. So the house of Saul is not at an end, as the medium conveyed the prediction of Samuel. So we have some suspicions about the medium. So just yes. As in the two accounts concerning the death of Saul, we believe one, but we don't believe the second. So in the two accounts beginning with the death of Samuel, we believe Abigail is telling the truth, but we have suspicions that the medium is not. She doesn't seem to be speaking the truth entirely. There seems to be deception in there. In other words, out of the numerous accounts in the books of Samuel where we meet deception, this is one more to add to that list. Not because we just want to, but because there is textual evidence that pushes us in that direction, given the context in which we're reading it. So what I've been arguing then is that 1 Samuel 25 and 28 are a pair of narratives to be read together, as numerous other pairs of narratives are in these books, and that Abigail and the medium are a contrasting pair. They have things in common, but they also have some obvious contrasts.
Uh-huh.
Abigail's prophetic words are confirmed by later events and by the prophet Nathan. No problems there. But the medium's predictive prophetic words are complicated by later events.
No.
That
sure.
Makes us suspicious. What would make me even more suspicious is that it comes right next to these two accounts of Saul's death, in which we know one is right and one is outright lies.
Yes.
So it's in that context that we read it. So, as is typical of biblical narrative, the narrator doesn't say, and the moral of the story is.
Right.
No.
Right.
No, you've got to participate in these biblical narratives. So readers decide, is the Amalekite lying or is he not lying? Well, that's the relatively easy question. But the other question is the medium genuine or is she not? Is she telling the truth or is she deceptive? Or if you want to be really, you know, complex, is she being deceived? It isn't just her attempt to deceive Saul, but is the medium herself being deceived by some other force? We don't necessarily have to go there. But that there is deception in the story of the medium of Endor It's not something that we just pluck out of thin air because it suits and confirms our prejudices. But there are narrative, literary, and contextual reasons for seeing it, and also confirming what marvelously complex literature the books of Samuel are.
That's amazing. Hearing things like this, for me anyway, make me want to run right back to Samuel and other books that have complicated stories like Judges to just read, you know, and it really highlights the fact that we are so, what's a good word? We just sort of dwell on the surface, you know, and oftentimes I remember having a professor tell me that's one of the problems with the Bible is that we've read it before. For those of us who've maybe grown up in the church or had theological education, where we're so familiar with it, but when we really start going back and revisiting stories and narratives that we assume we know, we really realize that we have not looked at it from as many angles as we could have to really bring out some new insights and helpful insights. Thank you for that work. So stepping away from the text now and kind of maybe bringing more practical pastoral applications. So what are some lessons, again, and I agree with you, I don't want to do like the Aesop's fable thing or like the, you know, and the moral of the story is, but for people who are hearing this for the first time and they're digesting all of this and synthesizing it in their minds, for you anyway, maybe what are some very quick soundbite takeaways on one level on how we interpret the Bible and sacred texts? And two, does that warning then, and I think it does, still hold true that sort of where there's deception here? Maybe just some real brief two or three takeaways, lessons that people can kind of help as they're synthesizing all of this new information. For me, anyway, I think one of them is it's worth revisiting stories that you think you're familiar with because you may not be, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think what it shows for me anyway is the importance of a close reading of the Bible.
Yes.
And one of the reasons why we're not good close readers of the Bible, the biblical narratives, you know, about 40-45% of the Bible is narrative. So we better be good at reading narratives if we want to be good at reading the Bible.
Yeah.
The problem is that for many people in a similar culture to ours, you know, which I'm taking to be a kind of a typical like conservative Christian Western culture, we don't do well with stories. In fact, some of us are pretty suspicious of stories.
Yes.
So as soon as I found this myself, you know, where I talk about a Bible story and people immediately pounce on me and say, aha, fiction, that's what you're saying. So no, I'm not saying that.
Yeah.
I'm saying it's a narrative. And like all narratives, you know, they'll have plots and they have characters and they work according to this. So a close reading of the Bible, yes. But we also underestimate the ways in which we can do theology. So in a Western context, we think theology is something like, well, let's say the 28 fundamental beliefs. We take the Bible, and theology is what we do with it. You know, we condense it, and we draw from all kinds of places in the Bible to give a synthesis of what the Bible says, and it's put together sort of using pretty sort of Aristotelian logic. You know, it's a abstract logical construct. Now, there's nothing wrong. You know, there's nothing wrong with that. That needs to be done. But one of the things, one of the ways which I sometimes point out the difference is that is not the way Jesus did his theology.
Yeah.
When Jesus did his theology, for example, you know, if you want to know what is the experience of salvation, well, you can turn to fundamental belief number 10, and you can read about justification, sanctification, adoption, sin, transgressions, being adopted as God's sons and daughters, all condensed. Fair enough, yeah. But you don't need me to tell you, you know, that isn't a quotation from the Sermon on the Mount.
That's right.
Fundamental belief number 10. But if I said to you, and Jesus said, there was a certain man who had two sons.
Yeah.
Well, you know what happens next. If you've heard that story once or twice, it stays with you for the rest of your life. What we tend to do is to say something like the fundamental belief is theology. the parable of the prodigal son is just a story. No, they are both theology, but they are theology in different modes. So one takeaway from this, I would say, is don't assume that theology is just a one-trick pony, that it has to have one particular form. It can take some different form. Now, in the 21st century, in my estimation, people are more open to narrative than they are to abstract propositional theology. Can we rewrite what we believe in terms, for example, I don't mean this is the only way of doing it, could we rewrite it in narrative form? Or can we only express it one way? And if we can only express it one way, which is the way we've always expressed it, it suggests we might not fully understand what we're talking about or see the implications of what we're talking about. But if we can take it from this genre and refashion it into another genre, you have to understand what you're talking about. And I'm one of these people that I find that narrative speaks to me more directly and, if you like, more spiritually than abstract propositional theology, because I can relate to characters who inhabit a world that I can relate to, whereas I'm sometimes left a bit cold by condensed syntheses.
That's powerful, and I really like that. I remember one of my major professors was a Kierkegaard scholar, and he would always talk about the indirect communication, lived experience, versus what he believed Kierkegaard railed against was sort of, I'm going to take these concepts, you know, truth and the gospel and love and hope, and I'm going to reduce them to propositional truths that you can have a mental assent to, but that doesn't necessarily mean, you know, you're getting all the nuances and an understanding of what those concepts are. You know, and even looking at some of the, you know, one I go to in this podcast and outside of this podcast is when Jesus tells the story of the rich man and Lazarus, you know, in Luke. And if you're simply going by propositional theology from a tradition that believes there is no immortal soul directly after death, that story has a lot of theological problems in it.
Exactly.
And to try to rewrite that and get that published maybe in some traditions, they would call you a heretic. And yet, here's Jesus saying, you know, two people died. One went, you know, to Abraham's, you know, bosom, and the other one is in hell, and they had a conversation. And there's all kinds of issues with that. But the point is not a literal interpretation to add another proof text, you know, to our propositions, but there's this narrative about justice and how we treat people.
Yeah.
And I feel like you've really highlighted an issue I think that I run into. I know in our you know, shared tradition of Seventh-day Adventist Christians, where we don't do narrative very well. We can maybe mentally recognize the power of stories, whether it's a children's story or putting an illustration in a sermon, but really recognizing how much narrative and narrative theology is in the Bible, we haven't done as much with that as I think we could, and really fleshing out a bigger, fuller, richer theology. And part of that may be just a fear, and I don't want to suggest this about anyone specific or somehow suggest this is a nefarious, intentional thing, but we like control. And I've seen Bible studies with, you know, they'll ask a question, they'll give you a Bible text, and then right underneath where you're supposed to write your answer, they'll give you the answer. They just you cannot risk anyone not having the same verbatim answer.
Fair.
Versus Jesus's parables, where frequently people heard him and they were baffled. The disciples were baffled. What in the world is that? And it's interesting with the form of a parable is you don't tie it up neatly, and then that creates more participation with people's imagination, with their intellect. They ask questions, they try to resolve it. Versus if I tie it up real neatly, well, I don't have to think about it very hard, and I can just go back about my business. Versus, you know, whether it's a Bible story, a great work of fiction or cinema, you walk away and it's going to bother me all day long trying to, you know, unpack that. And I'm really engaged with the narrative. So I really appreciate you highlighting.
And that makes the Bible interesting. If we just domesticate it, you know, like we've got to keep this dog on a lead, you know, he's got a heel. We risk it running off. We don't want that, as you said, sort of control. But the number of times when Jesus, as you said, tells a parable, a narrative, and then asks a question, you know, who was which of these was a neighbor to the man, you know, who fell among thieves? It's asking for a response, yes, but it's also asking for imaginative engagement. And I think that many of these narratives, like the one we've been, the medium of Endor we've been looking at, demands imaginative engagement on the part of the reader, simply, you know, checking a list of facts. You know, the medium was A, a woman, B, a man. All right, we've got that sort of, she lived in Endor in Jerusalem. No, she lived in Endor. You know, you can just tick off the facts, but you would then miss the imaginative way in which this narrative dovetails into the rest of the book of 1 Samuel, which is, I think, the way to see things that you wouldn't see before if you didn't do that.
This has been brilliant. Thank you so much, Dr. Turner, for coming on Beast and Bible Podcast and helping us walk through this challenging narrative through biblically responsible interpretation methods and keeping our imaginations intact.
Okay, it's been a pleasure.
So, what do you think of our take on The Witch of Endor? For me, this takes into account the whole book of Samuel, not just an isolated passage. It also doesn't negate the dangers of the occult for Christians. It keeps intact the Bible's perspective that, quote, the dead know nothing, end quote, Ecclesiastes 9:5. And it prevents us from too much speculative theology around a shadowy figure claiming to be Samuel. Of course, this brings up the entire idea of an underworld and the Christian doctrine of hell, which are monsters in and of themselves that deserve their own episodes. For now, we'll reflect on the lesson that handling texts like the Bible require us to pay slow, careful attention to contexts and language so we don't create either superficial readings of them or artificial readings crammed into our theological presuppositions. Speaking of speculation, in our next episode, we deal with a beastly mark that has had humanity speculating for centuries as to what it might be. I hope you'll tune in. Thank you for listening to Beast and Bible.
Beast and Bible is written, researched, produced, and hosted by Dr. Seth Pierce. Ethan Geck is our editor. Logo design and social media by Chelsea Ernina. Equipment and tech help from the dynamic duo James Giganti and Stephen Husett. Producing and project help from me, Heather Moore. Thanks for listening to Beast and Bible. Tell your friends about us, and don't forget to leave a nightlight on after dark.